Welcome to FMI's Built-In Podcast. I'm Scott Winstead, FMI Consulting President. What does it take to lead lasting change at scale? In this episode, I'm joined by Bob Euler and Gary Sanderson. Bob is the former CEO and chairman of MWH Global, a post he held for 12 years inside of his 36-year career with the firm. During his tenure, Bob led the transformation of MWH's business platform from one country to 36 and from $100 million in revenue to over $1.6 billion. Through a combination of organic, geographic, and client expansion strategies and the integration of over 20 acquisitions, by the time he retired, MWH was ranked as the global market share leader in global wet infrastructure services by U.S. and international industry journals and the 12th largest ENR design firm in the world. Gary worked alongside Bob at MWH for a number of years in a range of global leadership roles, where he helped drive major strategic and organizational change initiatives. His roles included Senior Vice President and Chief of Global Strategic Planning, Managing Director of UK Operations, and Corporate Development Director. Today, Gary is the founder of Visualize and the author of The Change Engineer. Whether you're a CEO or a board member or a builder of teams, this conversation is packed with frameworks, insight, and experience that you can apply. Well, Bob and Gary, thank you for being here. Bob, welcome back to the show. Well, I look forward to diving into it. So why don't we go ahead and jump in? Bob, I want to start with you. I'd love to get your take on your previous life at MWH. When you were there, you and your leadership team created a sector-focused, vertically integrated business. At this stage, you now sit on multiple boards and serve various CEOs as a coach and as a strategic advisor. I'm curious how you define what a winning strategy looks like and maybe how that definition may have evolved over time.
I think often we find management teams or boards talking about strategies or initiatives that enhance their bottom line or their competitiveness. I always like to start with vision. Where do you want the company to go in 5 years or 7 years? And then strategy actually is the term that activates what you're doing to get there. So I often find, whether it be boards or management teams, that we always start the conversation too low and haven't cemented the top vision of the leader of the company.
Just building on that, so once you've worked with the team to answer the big question, what do we want the place to look like 5-7 years out? What's been your experience in terms of the most effective process for executing strategy?
Executing strategy is a very complicated formula, and one Gary helped me with a lot, and a basis of his book, quite frankly. But executing strategy has to do with assigning parts of the strategy to individuals, developing a vocabulary that's common and it's understood, finding initiators or people who own the end result, and I think experimenting and attempting to fail while you learn in that. So I don't think the initiatives of a strategy should be one. I think you should count on one of them, two of them not working, and then creating a set of strategies underneath that are owned by different individuals or teams that sort of sync together.
Yeah, Bob, as you and I were talking some time ago, remember you saying you knew where you wanted to take the company, but you didn't quite know how to get it there. Kind of building on that, what are the biggest lessons you've learned about overcoming internal resistance to change?
You know, I don't think I've solved that problem in my work with anybody. When you talk about strategy, it has a lot to do with differentiation and creating a value that clients want to pay for. And hopefully it's an ever-increasing value. The evolution of change threatens the status quo. And people who don't own the initiative doubt whether it'll either work, or if it does work, how it influences them, or do they lose control over what they want to stay in control of? So it's really quite challenging. I've seen two or three models, one where companies decide they want to do something and decide it's too hard to do internally, so they acquire something, bolt it on, and then integrate. And another one is to self-start an initiative. That's extremely hard, and there's two forms of that. One is inside the company, and one is a set aside outside the company where you let it nurture it as an embryonic play and let it get to a size before you reintegrate into the company?
You know, I think in one of our previous conversations, we talked about this concept of organizational antibodies. And so, Gary, maybe as a segue to you, I'd love you to kind of pick up on that same question, you know, this notion of overcoming internal resistance to change.
I spent, nearly 5 years with Bob in the US. And this was, I think, the biggest challenge and frustration was, how do you influence a set of people to move and change their behavior to align with the strategy? And I think that probably my biggest learning over that period was, it was all about an influence process. So when I returned to the UK, sharing Bob's frustration and interest in the human behavioral, psychological aspects of this, I took a degree in behavioral science. And that actually revealed, I think, a number of aspects which sort of validate the problem and the nature of the problem, which is that change is implicitly resisted. No matter the change that looks at surface level like a very positive, logical, rational, strategic way forward, we have a psychological reaction because it's change. And we are threatened by change because the status quo has kept us alive and successful to date. So the big learning I've had since, I think, is that it's less about fighting to change the people and more about changing the environment in which those people operate. Sometimes you need to change the people, of course, but generally, there's a great quote, I can't remember who said it, you can get anything done in this organization as long as it's not your idea. So the gold standard of change is that people are just influenced by the environment to do what's in their best interests, or in the best interests of the company, as in aligning with its strategy. And so that behavioral science has been the big area that's unlocked a whole raft of different perspectives, particularly as I look back on the work I did with Bob and what we did together, and why some things work really well and others maybe we found more challenging. So it's probably a couple of things just at the heart. One is the narrative. So that the emotional connection between the strategic vision and the execution has to be some sort of narrative. And every time Bob was in the room, that emotional connection was really strong. Of course, it becomes more challenging to translate that across an organization without the leader in the room all the time. And the second thing is seeking to change the environment and the things that wrap around people, so that they're influenced to do the behaviors that align with the strategy and nudge them away from the traditional, the conventional, the status quo.
You know, I read this the other day somewhere, and I can't remember where I read it, but it was, you know, when dealing with people, remember, we're not dealing with creatures of logic, but creatures of emotion. When you hear the word corporate gravity, what does that mean?
Well, what I'm seeing in the work I'm doing now is people being pulled down to the immediate moment. Their balance of their time is too much on the here and now in a reactive mode. And they're battling, and this, and I'm dealing with leaders, they're battling to elevate the right amount of their time to the right levels of strategic thinking. And again, that was, Bob and I talked about that, and it was a frustration 10, 15 years ago. And I think I'm actually seeing it worse. I think exacerbated by some of the ways that we're operating in a sort of technological post-COVID environment. So yeah, it's that pull to the here and now.
Bob, I love your take on that as former CEO and someone who works with CEOs now.
Yeah, I think there isn't enough thought in companies as to time management and the design of decision-making relative to where decisions are made by who. And most of the time, things float up for lots of reasons. One is for attention of the individual. Another is because if it won't be turned over if we get the top guy to say something about it. Another is we'll get more support and we'll get more people on board if the top guy supports it. And then you get into problem solving with today's degree of communication almost instantaneous. And there's more problems than there were yesterday. That you hear more problems about yesterday, you know, you hear more granularity in the whole thing. So that's the gravity that pulls you down. And the truth is that a strategy cannot be affected without the top leader's passion and vocabulary being constantly driven into almost even decision making. Why is this decision made relative to our strategy? I'm not doing this because it would interrupt what we're doing over here, kind of thing. So the logic of your decision making has to tie to your strategy too.
So that's a great segue into this next question, and something that we covered a little bit our last episode that you were kind enough to join, but it's one of my favorite leadership frameworks, and it's one that I think bears repeating, which is the four levels of leadership.
Well, just quickly, those four levels are different levels of distance and time. Whether, you know, level one is solving problems of the past, level two is kind of looking at how do we prevent the problems from occurring. Level three is where are our initiatives and how are they going? Level five, what is our platform of ultimate success? Is it, or are we trying to be a public company, a private company, a big company, a global company, whatever those are? But you almost have to segregate agendas in your time to different aspects of that because they commingle. You lose the benefit of the of one above it as such. So time management and segregation of decision making and discussion, I think, are not designed enough into our CEOs today.
Well, you know, kind of building on these couple of points from a corporate gravity standpoint, what we find a lot of times is you see the CEO and top leaders getting pulled down into the organization working on level one and two issues all the time. Because most folks tend to get promoted because they're world-class firefighters and problem solvers. And so it's a comfort zone that a lot of industry executives find themselves in. So it's natural versus, to your point, and the framework of the four levels is the board is paying you as CEO or as the top leaders to operate at levels three and four. And if you're not doing it, somebody's got to, and they'll find somebody that will be doing it. And so trying to reset the frame, and we use it a lot with strategic planning committees and boards to make sure that discourse and the agenda and the things that are being covered in the room are at the appropriate level and not what's happening on this project, because it's very easy for discussions to devolve into kind of the here and now, because there's always something happening inside these organizations.
I think so much of what we do is it comes, we solve, it comes, we solve. And it's very helpful to have some rules of thumb in management. Like, if it's not going to affect the profit of the company by 10%, why am I in this meeting? Or if it's this big or challenging thing, then this person should be in charge of it, not me. And I should be a listener, an advisor, not the decision maker. So there's a tendency for CEOs and high-level people to say, I know you think I'm in this room to make a decision, so I'm going to make one. Instead of saying, this isn't my decision to make. What's your recommendation? Go for it. Why am I even in this meeting?
It's a great philosophy. I'm curious how you get an organization there. I keep going back to the antibodies we talked about earlier. And I think there tends to be a healthy level of skepticism in many organizations. And it's very easy to become risk averse. Well, gee whiz, remember we tried that thing over there and we tried these things over there and they didn't work. And so why is this one going to work? And so it's almost got one hand behind your back going into the process or going into the initiatives.
When Gary was with me, vocabulary is important. And I said, well, the chief strategist of the company is the CEO. But the chief of strategy implementation, that's a different job. And that's the one Gary had, implementation of strategies. And that's the challenge of change management. So, Gary, why don't you talk a little bit about that?
The agenda that I found maybe most fascinating when I was in Colorado headquarters, but working globally with Bob, was around what we called integrated global working, which was to push the behavior of people sharing not just knowledge, but actually sharing work across the global platform of the company for innovation, differentiation, as well as for sort of cost arbitrage. It was very much founded, though, on the engine room that was fairly embryonic when I arrived in Colorado. It was maybe less than 100 people, and it was a risk, you know, of shrinking. And we took a very strong strategic decision to grow that capability in India as an engine room of intellectual capital, not just low value resource. And we succeeded in challenging a lot of stereotypes that people have about offshoring and low value work by having some of the cleverest people in the company and giving them license to innovate as well and build their teams moving out from India. So that was a fascinating agenda. And of course, the antibodies for a lot of that, as you'll remember, Bob, probably couldn't be greater because it challenges the sort of local look after my local team, which is understandable. I don't know these people. They're the other side of the world. And we put a lot of emphasis on the behavioral side of how does that work? How do you build the relationships, build the trust, build the understanding, build the workflows? But also there was an element of intent there that was visible and strong, albeit maybe in the background, in terms of, we're doing this. And it was built into the approach. It was non-negotiable. It came from Bob and the strategy. It was effectively owned, not by me, but by our chief operating officer. We drove it hard into the way that the businesses, each of the operating companies behaved. And so it was an illustration, because looking back, it was probably 80% soft influence, 20% very useful, hard-edged aspect to the intent, the metrics, the commercial model, et cetera, that drove that. But that as a behavioral journey was just fascinating. A lot of aspects of how the company back then connected people globally, when I look through a behavioral lens, I think we really got it right. Maybe by intuition, maybe by a bit of luck, but looking back through a behavioral lens, we really got it right. And it was very reinforcing for everybody who was involved. So if you can create an environment that reinforces what makes people want to go to work, to connect with people who are bringing the best to the table and learning from them wherever they might be in the world, to collaborate on things that might not be in your backyard, but might be being created somewhere else in the world, that can be incredibly behaviorally reinforcing. And when you get those lined in the right direction, it was very, very powerful. And it's interesting because what I see with the larger a company gets, ironically, I think the internal network reduces in scale. And I've seen that in companies. I think it was impacted by COVID. So the level of connectivity across the organization reduces. So we had, I think, a sweet spot for a period of time where the connectivity that could share knowledge and work around the world was very, very powerful and absolutely differentiating.
I think one of the things that's very important is that organizations have wiring diagrams, but they don't really operate that way. They operate with spider webs of networks. And within those spider working networks, there's some really important people. And it is not necessarily their rank that is important. It's their access to the network. And that spider web needs to be understood if you're trying to change anything. And I always used to say with our leadership, you need vocabulary to try to cut through, what are you talking about kind of thing. And one of the things that we were really concerned about was to make sure in the gradient of support, most people were in the middle, neutral, wait and see. Let's see what happens. I used to call them silk flags. The wind was blowing one way, it was going that way, next way it is. And then you had to the upper side some really passionate people, all the way to apostles, to advocates, to optimists. And then on the downside, you had pessimists, a little less than that, coffee room saboteurs, and what I called assassins. And the issue is, if you have a vocabulary like that, you can actually say, I think there's a lot of assassins in the room, you know, and this type of thing. And from an action point of view, my comment was always, you got to convert the assassins and the coffee room saboteurs into neutrals. Or if they control the spider web of networks, they're going to contaminate your ideas.
That's such an astute observation. I'd love to camp on that for a second. And Bob, in your work coaching CEOs, how do you impress upon them that point about, you know, there's your, as you said, your wiring diagram, the lines and boxes on your org chart, and then there's how the place really works and that spider web. How do you go about getting CEOs to understand the importance of that informal spider web and how to understand what it is and how it actually functions and how to use that to their advantage?
I've always felt that the corporate leadership, whether it be HR or finance or accounting, has a role which is greater than just the mechanism of that role. And in this case, HR, a strategic HR officer should study the dynamics of an organization and be able to tell you how it's operating by going out in the field and asking 1,000 questions. It's hard for a CEO to do that without just watching the room when you're not talking. And you watch who goes where, who's talking to who in what corner, and who's shaking their head versus nodding their heads. And so you can get your own intuitions, but trying to understand that is really important. If you just ask your HR directors, if they're intuitive and strategic, tell me the 25 people in this company that drive our strategy and the opinions of it. And don't worry about what the rank is. Just tell me. That's the 25 that you've got to get above the line of neutral. It's not just intuitive. It's cognitive. You actually got to go and, as a CEO, you got to go to someone and say, you know, I think you're sort of a coffee room saboteur on this thing, and I need you to get more neutral. I notice you have a following, and that's great. You have a following, but it can't be a contaminating following to me. Or maybe this isn't the right company for you. You know, maybe you should go to someone else's strategy you believe in as such. I'm not threatening you. I'm just saying I just can't have assassins in the organization.
It's easy to say, hard to pull off, right? In practice, at least we found with a lot of executives, having the courage to have those conversations as opposed to trying to subtly move somebody almost with more judo and getting them to come alongside and be more neutral versus the direct, hey, this is what I'm observing. Tell me if this is right or not. And then what's it going to take for you to get on board with the strategy? And if you can't, that's fine. But this may not be the organization for you. That says easy, does hard, as they say.
But I will tell you this, the people react fairly well to it. They may be in denial and say, I don't think you've got me right. I'm a lot more neutral than you think I am. And you go, good. Thank you. I misread you. Fine. Then they become more neutral.
Right. Right. What is it? The Hawthorne effect? Just the fact that your management quote is observing it, is seeing it. It helps people understand they may not be operating in the dark like they think they may be, or in the shadows. So, Gary, just to tap your expertise as it relates to this kind of informal spider web, I'm curious how this shaped some of your work on the strategy execution side.
That informal spider web network, I believe, is one of the biggest, perhaps intangible, but one of the biggest strategic assets for knowledge-based organizations. But the organizations that I connect with that I can feel the strength of that spider web are the ones that tend to be moving faster and more strategically. And the ones that are more localized without that connection across the organizations, they don't feel as agile and they don't feel as ready for the world that we're in. The dynamics I'm seeing is the ever-increasing speed of stuff driven by technology and all the other fascinating dynamics, geopolitical, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that you're just changing how we work. And there's no process or system that you could rule out that can deal with that complexity. And then when I look at organizations that I work with, there's sort of one of two paths. The path that most seem to go down is to keep trying to add more stuff. So as the external environment gets more complex for a knowledge-based organization, that's the opportunity. If you can help your clients deal with the complexity, that's your value proposition. But the issue is that complexity is also acting on you as your organization. And what I see many doing is they just add more stuff and they create this internal complicatedness. So the ones that are more agile are looking at a more behavioral set of behavioral norms rather than adding more stuff, more systems, more processes to deal with the complexity of the environments that they're in. And I think some of those behavioral norms are implicit in the strategy as we executed and drove back in MWH around reinforcing and investing in the global network, recognizing that those connections are not just lines in an org chart. Those are relationships. They're two directional. Each one of them has got something in both directions. And what flows through them is not just transactional information, that it's knowledge, it's stories, it's connection. So there's a lot more psychology behind every one of those connections. You know, so you're getting much more into almost an analogous to how the brain operates versus like an old style calculator. So there's so much in that space, Scott, about how we tackle in knowledge-based organizations this wave of complexity and ride it, not get washed away by it. that sits behind the spider web and the value of that spider web?
You know, it's a great point. I hear executives from firms that we would say are very focused and have a strategy that's well articulated, that there's alignment behind, that stay focused. And there's almost this operating ethos that we've got to kill as much as we create. So if we're going to add a new process or a new initiative or a new thing, we've got to kill something, because we can't be net adding to the bag over and over and over until the bag breaks. There's like, resources are finite, be it capital, be it human, or whatever. And operating within constraints tends to, it's cliche for a reason, tends to breed creativity and more focus. But there's a, you know, this whole military phrase, like all thrust, no vector. You need intensity, but you also need direction clarity. Back to Bob, a point you made earlier, we don't know where we're going, any road will take us there. So what's the vision that we're solving for? And then let's go about reverse engineering to solve for it. You both touched on something I want to come back to, and that's this notion of really tapping in this network and the influencers inside the business, and this idea of scaling ideas. So Bob, when you were in the role, you used to travel all the time, all over the world. But I remember you telling me one time you would ask your team, when you would sit down with them one-on-one, what are the ideas that they're most excited about? And then you would look for ways to scale those best ideas. What was it that you were listening for as you were in those conversations to know what to scale for?
My pattern was to basically, at every visit of every office, spend a third of the time with the senior management, a third of the time with the clients, and a third of the time with the general people in the audience. And it was in that latter that I would say, what do you think is the most innovative, sexiest solutions that you've had in this last year or 2 years or 3 years? And tell me why you think so. And you would listen to it through the sieve of, is this repeatable? Is the concept of what they're talking about, forget about the details or what the problem of the client was, but is the concept of the solution a repeatable template? And once you figured out it was, and that could be used in many places and it would cross geography. And you'd say, well, now I got to find a mechanism to capture that and basically store it and be able to recall it to others with examples of how to do it. And this was the start of a lot of our knowledge management efforts to get synergy out of geography. The fact that we had 140 offices meant we had 140 unless we could find out a way to make 1 + 1 = 4 or 5. And that's the repeatable concept. This was how we ended up doing it. It was fun because it wasn't a new initiative. It was already a proven solution somewhere. And so it helped the first criteria. This isn't going to work. He said, well, it worked over here. Those are just random ideas. But what we were really looking for is repeatable solutions that could be plugged in and taken out by different sectors and places in the company quickly.
Way before I was in the States and he visited the office that I led in the UK. And yes, he spent the time with the local client. He spent the time with our leadership team. And then he wandered around with me and he kept stopping and having really detailed conversations with people at their desks about what they were working on as I was trying to move him on to where he was meant to be next. And he would get really in depth, and that's what he was doing. And it was very impacting for the people that he connected with in that process as well.
Well, I think, Bob, you touched on this. When you're doing that and you've got somebody who's got an idea that has already worked, it's a proven solution, right? And so going back to a concept we talked earlier about as it relates to organizational antibodies, people tend to be 5 times more likely to support things they help create. So if it's their solution, you've already got an advocate in the business. And chances are within that office, other advocates who have either seen it or done it themselves. And so you create that inertia, positive inertia, right out of the gate. You both mentioned this earlier. You know, leadership's job is to create the environment for the right behaviors to show up. What does that look like in practical terms?
There's some simple things, the complicatedness that we tend to create. So we tend to make it really quite easy for people to do what you don't want them to do. And it's quite hard for them to do what you actually want them to do. So that would be one. It almost sounds simplistic and a bit trite, but the easier you make it for people to do what you want them to do, and the gold standard of that is that they do what you want them to do by default, one of the first things that you learn in behavioral science, if you're trying to nudge people's behavior towards, you know, healthy eating or saving for retirement, if you can make it a default, that's an easy way. So applying some of these principles from behavioral science, if I can get a leadership group together and you give them a concept like that, they immediately can come up with 10 things that are getting in the way of why their people aren't doing X, Y, Z. And so instead of just blaming them, well, you're responsible for the environment. It's perfectly designed to give you what you're getting. So how do you attract attention when people are in a very noisy environment and their brains are completely full already? You might think you're broadcasting a very clear, compelling message, but for them, it's lost in the noise. So if you as a leader visit an office and give a great talk, the people might be 100% behind you, really compelling, you get what you're saying. By the time they get back to their desk and they sit down and nothing around them's changed and nobody's behaving differently, then why would they do anything different? So if the local leadership, which is probably the biggest part of the environment, is generally not the CEO, who might be a long way away, or even the local regional director, it's the local person of influence who may or may not be very high up the org chart. And that's back to Bob's point. Those have got the influence on people's behavior. People will follow what they see every day. And the other one that's maybe the most powerful that I saw and it built on our approach to knowledge sharing was a sort of social environment that we exacerbated through knowledge communities. So a knowledge community is a group of like-minded people global, and process engineers, great example. You get three process engineers in a room from different parts of the world. They are instantly brothers. So if you share through that network, that trusted solution, which might not be trusted initially, but because it's coming from a trusted source from within that band of brothers, it moves much more quickly, much more likely to be adopted.
So about shifting gears now, in your work with CEOs and on boards, how do you counsel them, you know, whether it's working one-on-one with a CEO, how do you counsel a new CEO, what that means in practical terms and how to actually bring it about?
I was very influenced once when a British interviewer interviewed Che Guevara, and he asked, how do you create a revolution? What do you do first? And Che Guevara said, you get control of the radio station and you tell the people where the country is going to be under your leadership 5 years from now. And it struck me as simple and directive about what you're trying to accomplish really early. And the radio station for a company is multifaceted, especially in this communication era we're in. It's not just the newsletter. It's not just the annual report. It's not just the town hall meetings. There are hundreds of mechanisms of the radio station that go into, and people need to feel like there's movement towards something. It's not just solving problems every day or getting more work and eating it and then finding more backlog. It has to do with momentum of a company going somewhere with leaders who can describe it in a positive and optimistic way. That's where I try to get CEOs to think really hard about, are they doing that? Because it takes some continuity of thought and takes some conviction that that's what you want to do.
I really appreciate both of you taking the time to get together today. And just to wrap up, Bob, you know, in your work on multiple boards and with CEOs, I love your take on what are the most common traps you see CEOs fall into?
Well, the first one is the trap of trying to make too many decisions and not having a delegation capability. It is where you put your attention, and whether you do it by no design and just let the environment drag you into it, or you actually design your time in such a way that you partition it for different levels of problem solving. So I had a very strong feeling that I had to discipline myself. And so every work week, I'd either be on the road or in the office, but in the office, there was a certain time for different things. And always there was time for level four stuff. If I ended a week and got to Sunday and said, did they do any level four stuff? Did they do any level three stuff? And the answer is no. That was a bad week for me in how I wanted to manage my time. So time management is huge. And Now I watch CEOs, and you know, I used to think getting 60 emails a day was tough, but these guys must get hundreds. I mean, in terms of the network of information that flows all over. But it's very, very easy to be a problem solver. I mean, I'm an engineer. A lot of the engineers with clients I have, they've been promoted because of their ability to sort and solve problems. They haven't been promoted to create enterprise or to reduce the antibodies of progress or to change the commercial model to a higher value stance. That's a new skill requirement. And so I think having people on your board or advisors or mentors who can keep reminding you of that in a positive way, that you redesign how you spend your time and attention.
You know, it's kind of back to that notion that CEO role is the intersection of all contradictions. It's deliver short-term results while investing in long-term performance. You know, take the time to do the analysis and gather the facts while moving fast to capture all the opportunities. So it's kind of the facts and the feelings versus the head and the heart, or the big idea vision versus how the heck are we going to get this done? You know, the CEO has to weigh all those different contradictions and still be able to make sense of the business and the environment and move the place forward. And so that, again, just coming back to that level one through four mental model to just kind of hit the reset button every week to see, you know, where have you spent your time is really good advice.
And by the way, there's very little reward in level four or level three on an immediacy point of view. Most of the time you're dealing with resistance or trying to convince people or trying to manage a different world in front of you. It's much more rewarding to solve problems in level one and two. So it's almost one where a CEO's got to say, I'm not here to make myself happy. I'm here to create the job I was designed to do, which is take the enterprise somewhere.
Absolutely. Well, that's probably a great place to end the conversation in terms of taking the organization someplace. Bob, as always, great to talk with you. I always walk away having learned a ton and getting a number of additional stories that I can weave into future conversations. And Gary, again, thank you so much for lending us your expertise and joining the conversation as well. It's great to be with you both. Thank you for listening to another episode of Built In. And please remember to like or subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode.